the pressing of like three buttons is really all it takes to make something happen once you've placed an image on the scanning bed.
We are in session on clocktower.org. I'm Rachel, and I'm here with Paul John and Lee Hunter from Risograph for Activism. Lee is a visual artist based in Brooklyn, and Paul John is an artist, printer, and publisher who likes books and collaborative projects. First off, thank you both for coming to Red Hook.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So this class is oriented around using the Risograph to print images and text that are taking a political stance. I want to start by asking where this interest in resistant printed material started for each of you. Was it in the studio or at a rally or in the library?
You know, I think a lot of times when you think about resistance, you think about what kind of resources you have available to you and what kind of skills you can bring to it. So I don't have money, and so I can't really help in that way. But I knew that I had a skill set that was fast enough for people to make material. And so I just thought it was a good fit for considering the uncertain future of the world, and not just this country, but just thinking about resistance in general. I never thought that you should stop being resistant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's always good to keep that as like a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
My hobby is resistance.
I look at Lee when I think of that. I'm like, who do I think, you know, plots while they daydream or while they're sitting in the shower or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I've been in, I don't know, the relationship with print, I think, is kind of falling with what PJ was saying, is that it's a very accessible medium, right? And there's a spirit and a long tradition of radical printmakers and publications and newspapers and books and zines. And now I think that Risograph kind of adds like another printing methodology to the set of tools that we have, and it has like hot pink, which is a great bonus from like the Xerox copy days.
Yeah.
And I think print is great because it's so accessible and it always offers other voices that are not going to necessarily be in more hegemonic information systems.
Does the Risograph have a history of being used to print these kinds of materials?
I don't think so. It's got such a short history in general.
Especially in the U.S.
Yeah.
I feel like Risograph prints came up on my radar, like the IPRC in Portland in about like 2008. And they were always kind of like hard to find. And it was usually like really cute cartoony zines.
Yeah, exactly. Mostly for comics or something.
Yeah, it's usually been for more for comics. I think now as the machine is more widely available,
it's
getting used a lot more. And Chris Duncan with Land and Sea,
right?
He does a lot of pretty politically based work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mark Fisher from Temporary Services and I'm forgetting his name. Josh McPhee.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He does a lot of offset litho, though, and silkscreen.
Yeah, but recently I think he's been doing some Riso. But also, you know, the history of print, you know, most people did, like, woodblock and offset or litho. And, you know, that's, like, volume, so you can make a lot of prints. And not as many colors, but a lot of prints in various sizes. But it is funny to note, like, there are institutions, like Casa del Hijo de Ahuizote in Mexico City was like a subversive press, and all the members of that press were eventually found by the government and killed. So it's like you can use this medium of print to upset a lot of people to the point that they would want to kill you.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, the Riso specifically here in Red Hook, it's like in the middle of quote-unquote nowhere, New York, but you know, it's kind of liberating to feel like you can bring these things that maybe you wouldn't want to take to a Kinko's or you wouldn't want to take to your office and print these there. You can come to a very remote place and kind of test out ideas.
Mm-hmm. Also, Kinko's is no fun because now you have to pay for it.
it
was better when they had the blue cubes.
Yeah,
you could just sneak in and photocopy till your bag was so full you had to like drag it away with you. Kinko's kind of stinks now. Like yeah. I think it, and I like that the Rizzo is more accessible, right? And
it's
like
definitely more democratic now.
It is a lot more democratic now.
It's a cheap way to print with spot colors, right? So when, you know, digital printing sort of took over, everything, every color was just a combination of CMYK. So anytime you print like an image on your home printer, it's just using these CMYK channels to create a full color image. But if I wanted to print something in blue, it's not blue ink that's going on the page. Whereas with a risograph, if I want to print something in blue, I pull out this blue drum and it's blue from the start, and it's just more vibrant, and there's lots of just sort of idiosyncrasies that you can play with because it's an analog process. You know, you're scanning black and white originals on like an old scanning bed.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things that are more analog offer more control usually once you learn how to master them, and so there's kind of an allure to learning about it, learning sort of the nuances of each particular machine, ways that paper works, all sorts of things like that, because at the end of the day, it's really just your time and a little bit of money for paper and ink that goes into making some really awesome looking projects.
Because I feel like there's kind of a, there's like a Rizzo rebirth happening right now. Like there's a lot of interest in learning how to use them. There are a lot,
totally,
lot of people making art with them, and I'm curious like why you think that's happening now, because we've had these for a while, right?
They've only been around since 1986, but duplicators have been around forever. So like hectographs, mimeographs preceded this, and then there was, you know, digital duplicators, but mostly mimeographs. Mm-hmm. And then in the 1986 is, I think, when they put out the first Rizzo model.
Not commonly accessible in the U.S., though.
Mm-mm. No, not like in other countries. Like Russia, they're really popular. South America, they're really popular. And in the Netherlands now, they've become really popular, but only for art purposes. You know, like artists are mostly using them over there. But yeah, I don't know why. I can't really say why people like it, but you can kind of see it on their faces when they leave the class. It's mostly because they have a lot of ideas and they don't really know how to translate them. But then within a day, you can figure out something to do on a Rizzo and walk away with two color prints or three color prints or a small book. There's like a lot of possibilities.
Like more gratification than like silkscreen gone wrong.
Exactly.
Leaving after the end of the day with like nothing but covered in paint prints, like broken emulsion.
And maybe like three good prints or like
maybe
10.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you didn't even get past the screen. I've had that happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you did a presentation for the class, mm-hmm, on a number of different historical movements and like associated posters.
Mm-hmm.
Have you always been doing this research? Like how?
Yeah, I've been involved in sort of independent publishing conversations on the radical left for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that list was mostly what I could come up with off the top of my head. And I've done a lot of research on the history of the left as a way to sort of understand the different points of activism I've been involved in, to understand like the history and lineage of dissent in North America as well as on a more global level. I did focus primarily on North America, the U.S. for this class because it was only a 20-minute presentation. And as I like started digging around, I was like, I could talk for hours. Must contain myself. And so I just really wanted to focus on the movements that have been going basically since the civil rights movement. A lot of the really amazing sort of poster and demonstration visual culture that comes up prior to the civil rights movement or is like handwritten mm-hmm. or typography. And I kind of wanted to focus on like graphics. the '60s and seventies, the graphics, just in terms of the visual culture. And then also the way that the left is usually, especially the far left is usually pretty anti-copyright. So those images really keep coming round and round and round. And so when I was going through and pulling these images, I was like looking at stuff that I remember from like my first demo and like remembering where it came from. And then like looking at the history of print collectives in the U.S., especially around social movement issues, is also pretty cool because there's a lot of radical collectives and like people teaching classes and that spawning off like other groups. And I kind of want to, in the spirit of resistance and what PJ had explained to me for this class, I was like, this should be like a fun.
It was a no-brainer.
Yeah, it was really it was fun. I mean, it got a little weird when we get into like the 2000s and start getting like flashbacks. I'm like, no, I remember that. It's bad.
Well, it's cool. It's cool that you mentioned the print collectives because it is funny. You don't see it so often, except for maybe in the sciences, where people who are practicing in a collective where like the teacher literally 5 years later is working amongst his students.
Absolutely.
You know, they become peers almost instantaneously, and it's like very exciting to see how fast that can happen and how different those voices then become, you know.
And that's also another reason why I like the history of print and printmaking in general. I'm not the best printmaker. I'm actually kind of bad at it because I can't draw, but it's always great because like printmaking shops are always these kind of like, they're always kind of community spaces. Like printmaking equipment requires space and it requires equipment and there's always people around. It's like very rare to like print by yourself, you know.
There's a lot of time.
Yeah, and especially when you're doing like intaglio prints and you're in like a larger print shop environment. I like how collective is, and there's a lot of collaboration because it takes a lot of different people to make these projects happen. So that's why I like it.
Yeah, especially when you have like many hours that you're working on an image and you're in a room with other people working on images and you have these conversations, and even just informally these different small collaborations can happen and pop up in each other's work.
And when you get into publishing books, you know, you've got somebody who writes it, somebody who edits it, somebody who does images, somebody who designs a cover, somebody who runs the press, somebody who, like, puts the book together. So, and, like, a lot of what you do is really collaborative with
Yeah, but, definitely includes a larger ecosystem. You're not working with the same skilled persons, working with people from all different scales of experience and also class and resources. So you really get more of a rounded view of society because you're not just working with other painters or you're not just working with gallerists. You're working with somebody who has like a basement that looks insane, full of paper and sewing equipment and, you know, is making thousands of books every night or something. So it is different.
Were there certain themes or images or icons that people have like really brought back in the back every few years or have been particularly kind of like attracted to?
Yeah.
The fist is iconic.
The fist and also Goya's Europa.
Yeah.
That one like does the rounds every 10 or 15 years. It's usually the version that happened at UC Berkeley that gets redone.
Yeah.
What else happened? I have to think about that.
I think there's also in activism and printmaking, there's sort of a long history of that traditionally being silkscreen. And I think that lends itself to a certain aesthetic, sort of like large block colors and sort of like very iconic graphic work that is essentially analogous to how the risograph works. So I think it both works in the same sense of like the economic model of sort of like cheap DIY, like low barrier of entry, but also like it continues like an aesthetic model that has sort of existed for a long time in terms of like activism.
Again, I think it comes back to the fact that you can get these very sort of like bright images that respond well to very like kind of basic design, like, you know, intense saturation of color, nice overlay, overprinting. And again, there's like an element of collage that can happen very easily. So I think that all of those things kind of lend itself to that. But then also, like, if you want to put the time in, you can make some really beautiful objects. But like I said, you can also print, you know, 100 pages a minute. So if you're looking to disseminate information quickly, that's a pretty easy way to do so, as long as you have networks of distribution, whether that's, you know, groups of people handing things out or posters or whatever it is.
I think it just, you know, it occupies a similar space in, like, certain social spheres as, like, Xerox machines did in the 90s. Like, you know, there was, like, all these little Xerox zines being passed around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, it's a similar thing. And in that way, it's, like, the democracy of the medium translates into, like, an effective form of, like, communication for activists.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to go back to something we were talking about earlier, that I think the class is sort of rotating around, which is this question that I've heard from a lot of artists recently, that they're unsure what the role is of the arts in these times of political and social upheaval, and a lot of artists trying to find a way for themselves to be active and engaged in what's happening politically. And of course, print has a long history of being involved in that conversation. I'm just wondering what you both think about that, that concern.
I mean, I think that every time there's a polarizing moment and sort of a new group of people gets radicalized, these questions kind of come up. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the thing that interests me about it is more of like the ongoing history of resistance. And like, we people have been struggling for a long time with the same problems. We are in a particular moment where some things are more obvious than others. Mm-hmm. And it's great that people are upset. And I think that they at some point will figure out that question for themselves. I mean, there's really no answer. You're just a person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to figure out what you need to do. And it's going to be different for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think. Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what else to add to that, but it's true. I mean, there's like every point of human history, there's been some sort of oppression or some sort of dominance and exploitation. So I think it's awesome that people are getting more mobilized now, but
it
becomes a more larger question, right? Like, if you want change, how do you make the change? Do you personally run for office? Do you personally take these responsibilities on? And these are larger responsibilities, you know. You're talking about representing other people and being liable for them, being responsible for how they live their lives. And when we ask questions of our Congress and Senate, those are the questions we should be asking, right? Like, you're making decisions on my behalf and all of these people around me as well. So, again, why I like DIY printing is because we can ask those questions and not have to have any sort of filter. You know, we can immediately distribute that kind of content.
And another thing that's really nice about print is it can be done anonymously.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And for certain things, being anonymous is a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not on the internet.
So, exactly.
Like, if you have certain things that you want to say that you know will cause you other life problems, which have been known to happen from time to time,
right,
print is still the most, like, secure way to transmit ideas anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about that that's kind of awesome because there's it still works that way.
It's the best form of signal around.
Right. And also sometimes you can get to a local audience with print, like by wheat pasting or putting posters up or, you know, actually handing stuff out. Or you can access people in a way that maybe not everybody's got the internet. I know that that's hard for everyone to remember. But, like, not everybody uses the internet or has a smartphone. And, like, when we talk about class and environments in the city, it's like, this is a different way for you to disseminate an idea.
Yeah, and it's easy to pin it up on your board or keep track of it or find it again rather than scrolling down your feed to find something.
I mean,
or...
until we run out of trees.
The Risograph Digital Duplicator. It was produced by combining the principles of stencil printing with Riso's original technology. The fact that these products are in active use in more than 180 countries and regions around the world is proof of their global uniqueness and ease of use.
So you were talking about the Risograph aesthetic.
Uh-huh.
How would you describe the Risograph aesthetic?
Like lo-fi, hi-fi in a weird way, if that makes sense.
You've been listening to In Session.